Dogs are an important part of our lives, and keeping them protected is a top priority, especially against nasty parasites. That's why you gotta check out NexGard Plus, Afoxolaner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel Chewable Tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection that kills fleas and ticks, prevents heartworm disease. Plus, it treats and controls roundworms and hookworms. That's a whole lot of protection packed into a delicious beef-flavored, soft chew designed to make monthly dosing easy and enjoyable. So the next time you're at the vet, ask about NexGard Plus Chews. They're the one-and-done monthly parasite protection you want for your dog. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive.
Hey, I'm so glad you're here with me for another episode of Talk Farm to Me. It's amazing how many different kinds of farms there are, don't you think? Farming touches our lives in so many ways. Every single day of our lives, the sweater I'm wearing, the t-shirt, the jeans, the shoes, the delicious chicken sandwich on sourdough bread with sweet pea microgreens that I had for lunch, the ethanol in my gas tank. Once your consciousness for what farmers do expands, it can be overwhelming. Do you feel that? Maybe overwhelming is the wrong word, but for me, the awe and respect I have for farmers deepens with every episode. Today, we are going deep to Deep Mountain Maple in West Glover, Vermont, in an area known as the heart of Vermont's Northeast Kingdom, which is just 25 miles south of the Canadian border and 42 miles north of Montpelier. And not that you're wondering about this yet, but it's also 353 miles, nearly 6.5 hours of drive time north of New York City. We'll get to that later. Deep Mountain Maple harvests the sap from thousands of maple trees and uses a wood-fired process to produce maple syrup, maple sugar, maple cream, and fine maple candies. It's a farm built on passion and wonder and a painstaking process where the strength of a harvest is dependent on a very personal and sustained dance with nature. Stephan Cantor and her husband Howie have been sugaring, as it's called, for more than 35 years. Today, you have the good fortune to hear all about this old-fashioned and time-tested craft from Stephan Cantor, who I'd like to call a sugar farmer, a sap farmer, or a maple farmer, but in the biz, she's called a sugar maker. Here we go.
I think that people love their maple syrup on their pancakes, but they don't really think about all that goes into it. And so that is what I really want to share, and I want to hear it from you. I would love to really start with your process. And I love that you were calling it the sugar bush, which isn't something I've ever heard before.
Let me begin by saying that all of the process of collecting sap from the sugar maple trees and boiling it to produce syrup, all of it is called sugaring. And the person who does it is a sugar maker. And the maple forest is called a sugar bush. And the place where we boil the sap to syrup is a sugar house. So that it's all about sugar and sugaring. My own research, and I think it's generally agreed that though that terminology dates back to sort of some of the earliest European efforts at making sweet stuff from maple, because what they were after, the colonists who learned about this from the indigenous people already living in the Northeast when they arrived, the goal was to reach something more solid than liquid maple syrup. So more of a cake of sugar. that was easily transportable and highly nutritious and energy producing. So, and then there was this other very interesting historical factor in there, which is that a lot of people in the Northeast in colonial times saw sugaring maple trees as a way to replace the cane sugar that was coming from the Caribbean region, which was produced by slave labor. So it was a particular cause of abolitionists who thought, oh, if we could produce our own sugar here in the Northeast, we wouldn't have to buy that sugar produced by slave labor in the Caribbean.
That's a fascinating history.
The history of it all is very fascinating.
In fact, the sugar cane produced by slaves was a white product in its final state. And until recently, the grades of maple syrup and maple sugar that aimed to replace that saddled cane sugar product was graded in terms of its approximation to cane sugar's lightness, meaning grade A syrup is the lightest in color and was, for many years, the more sought-after variety.
It's obviously an ancient tradition. Before the earliest people doing it, as I said, were the indigenous people living in the Northeast. And the Northeastern U.S. and Canada are not the only places where there are sugar maple trees, but it's where they occur in such great numbers that I guess early people figured this out and began to concentrate the sap to syrup.
I thought I might throw in a fact or two about sugar maples for you here, just in case you want to impress your friends with your knowledge. First, a maple tree must be 45 years old before you can tap it to get sap for syrup making. And you can tap it for sap then for the next 100 years. It's a very long-term relationship that you can have with a sugar maple and the sugar bush it is a part of.
So anyway, that's the origin of all this terminology. And it varies region to region. These are the terms in Vermont. We call it a sugar house. I think in New York State, they more often refer to the place where you make the syrup as a sugar shack. But we don't think it's a shack. It's a building with a lot of integrity. So it's a sugar house. Anyway, that's where that comes from. So back to the sap, because that's the raw material that we're after, which we can boil and concentrate and use to produce syrup. The sap comes from the sugar maple tree, which is just one variety of maples. And it's so named sugar maple because it has a very high concentration of sugar in the sap, relatively. Now, I say high concentration. An average sap from a sugar maple tree this time of year, which is March, which is when the sap is flowing, it's only about 2% sugar. It could be less. It could be a little more. It varies according to the year, according to the water in the soil. The amount of water in the soil will affect it all. That also affects how much of a season we have. But anyway, the trees are pulling in water from the soil as they wake up from winter, and they're producing their own sugars. They're also pulling in minerals from the soil with that water. So they're producing their own highly nutritious food that's going to feed the new leaves or the buds until the leaves have unfurled and can do their magical thing, which is photosynthesis, which is producing their own food. But they need kind of a jump start. They need a kickstart in the season to get going when the spring is happening. So all the trees are pulling in water, producing this sap, sending it up to feed the new leaves. And our whole process is to take advantage of that. To put a little hole in every tree and a spout in the hole. And when this is happening, which is when the days begin to warm above freezing and the nights are still cold, but the days get warm.
Frosty cold nights and warm sunny days encourage the sugar maple's sap to flow. But when buds begin to form on the trees in late March and early April, the sap turns bitter in flavor.
The sap is moving up in the tree and then down again with the freezing and thawing. It's a pressure differential that happens in the tree. So at that time of year, we're going to, some of that sap is going to come out that hole, just a tiny amount. It's not going to harm the tree in any way. The tree is producing thousands of gallons of sap. We're taking maybe a few dozen gallons of sap, not even in the course of a season. So we're not really affecting the health of the tree with one little tap hole. So the sap comes out. Well, the sap is like water. It looks like water. It's thin. It's barely sweet. If you taste it, it's delicious. It's refreshing, but it's not sticky. It's not thick at all. And the entire process in its, theoretically, it's really simple. It's basic culinary reduction. We're just cooking it, concentrating the flavors. The Maillard reaction and other processes by the introduction of heat to it are creating chemical changes which produce more of the flavors of maple syrup. So we boil and boil and boil until we've concentrated that thin, barely sweet sap into thick, delicious, very sweet maple syrup.
It takes an average of 40 gallons of sap to produce just 1 gallon of maple syrup. So if you think about the 4.2 million gallons that the U.S. produced this year, mainly in the Northeast, that's 168 million gallons of sap.
Let me ask you a question. So back to the sugar bush for a minute.
Yeah.
Now you guys have been doing this for a number of years, maybe 36. 36 years.
Yeah.
So how big is this sugar bush, for example? Like how many trees?
Yeah. We own land, which is about 60, 65 acres of maple trees, sugar maples, sugar bush. And then we lease another bush, which is another 35, 40 acres. We sugar about 5,000 trees. Little over 5,000.
And how many miles of tubing is that?
Great question. I don't know.
Let's measure.
Many, many miles, because every single tree has a tap, has a spout in it, and every spout is connected to a little line of tubing, which goes into another line of tubing, which flows into a bigger one, which eventually all of the sap goes to big tanks, like 1,000-gallon tanks at the sugar house. And it's kind of, I say it's like plumbing the woods, if you want to imagine that it's all connected. And all that sap is flowing, eventually, all of it winding up at the sugar house. Now, because our forest land is hilly, uphill and down, so sometimes we have a tank in a low place and that sap has to be pumped back uphill to the sugar house. But generally the idea is you want to take advantage of the gravity. Vermont is a very, very hilly state. Most of the places where syrup is produced are pretty hilly. So we take advantage of the gravity. We also use a vacuum system, which pulls the sap through the lines and helps to keep sap from sagging in a line, remaining in a line. You just want to get it through the line and into the tank, again, as I said, as quickly as possible, because the sap is very volatile, and you want to boil it as soon as you have it.
Now, you were saying that you get started in March. How long does this last?
Well, it may last up to 6 weeks. That would be a nice long season. It could be 3 or 4 weeks. The thing is, it's completely weather dependent and we have no control over it. So, as I said, the sap begins to move in the trees when the days warm up above freezing. As long as the nights are still freezing, the trees aren't going to bud because it's not time yet. And this process will continue. as soon as the trees begin, as the new little buds begin to open, it's over. It's finished. So once it gets warm and stays warm for an extended period of time, that's signaling the end. Because when the trees begin to bud, they release compounds into the sap that make it taste foul. And the sap won't behave. To boil it, you can't make syrup out of it, and you have to stop. That's the end.
So can we talk about that for a minute? Because as our climate changes and we have warmer temperatures, warmer winters, cold, strange weather changes, like what's happening in Vermont, and what are you and your friends who also understand this important industry for your state, what are you guys talking about?
Well, I think what we're seeing is in 35 years, we're seeing weather that is more extreme and more unpredictable. So I'm no climate scientist, but I know that climate scientists are take pains to point out that there's a big difference between climate, between what the weather is doing over a long period of time and weather year to year. So we feel like sugaring is starting a little sooner than it used to. It's kind of generally understood that we're probably going to start sugaring a couple of weeks earlier than we did 30 years ago. But I have to say, at the same time, that's also partly due to changes in the technology in the last 30 years. We can tap the trees and have those tap holes yield sap for longer without drying up. So let me explain. When you drill a little hole in a tree, you're scarring the tree, right? It's no big deal for the tree. It's like if you got a bug bite or something on your arm, but or maybe a scrape. But left alone, as soon as that tree is scraped or the little hole is drilled, the tree is going to start to heal itself. And what it's going to do is it's going to scar over that and dry up. So in the old days, when we hung buckets, and in the early days of the move to plastic tubing, these systems weren't airtight. And so as soon as you drilled that hole, you had a very limited amount of time that hole would yield sap before it dried up and it was over. 6 weeks was about maximum. And so you had to really think about when you're going to tap and when you're going to start. And here in the northeasternmost corner of Vermont, I mean, our springs are late. So when we used to hang buckets, we didn't even start hanging buckets until the middle of March, to be ready at the end of March to hopefully get a season that lasted through most of April. Now, because we have these airtight systems, and we also have some other little interesting technological advances in the spouts themselves, that mean that we can tap in January. We can tap early, and the hole's not going to dry up until we pull the spout out at the end of the season. Then the tree will do its thing and heal that spot. So now we can catch a run that's very early. That in 30 or 40 years ago, you probably would have missed that because you just hadn't tapped yet.
With your miles and miles of tubing and many, many acres of your 5,000 or so trees, I'm curious, like, who's running all of these lines? Are you doing this? Or you have a team? Like, what's the process like?
Our operation for all these years has been mostly my husband, Howie, and myself. But we always hire some help during the season. I mean, we're a year-round operation because we've made a business of it. But so during the season, we have a couple of people who help. And that's who help tapping, who help with all the setup, and then who help with the boiling when it's happening. So it's seasonal help, but yeah, it's there's like three, my husband and two other guys. And when we originally set up all the tubing, I set up a lot of it, and I worked a lot in the woods. As our business has grown, it kind of demands more of me to stay on top of that. And especially during sugaring time when we lose Howie. So it's a juggling act. The fact that we've made a year-round business out of this is a little unusual in maple production. Most people make their syrup. They store it in large drums, like 40-gallon stainless steel drums. We do too. But most people then sell that wholesale at the end of the season. They may keep a little for their family and friends, or maybe they have a little account here or do some online stuff. But mostly the syrup gets sold in bulk to the big packers. But because we've got the business to run, we have that going on too. But back to your question. As far as the sugaring operation, right now I'd say there's four of us.
Impressive. Tell me
all the tubing gets set up. We don't take that down. So that stays up year round. Every year it needs repair. After a few years, tubing needs to be replaced, but it remains the plumbing in the woods all year. The spouts in the trees get removed at the end of the season. So then next year, the tap hole is in a very different place, and it's a new spout. So that's only in the tree during the season, but the tubing remains in place. So it's not like we're setting it up from scratch every year.
Vermont is a major player in the maple syrup business. It's number one in the United States, which produced a record 4.2 million gallons of maple syrup in 2022. Vermont is responsible for more than 2.5 million gallons of that total, followed by New York in a distant second with 845,000 gallons a year. Quebec is the largest producer of maple syrup, producing 70% of the world's maple syrup.
Okay, that's very helpful. I'm still impressed. I'm still wholly impressed with you and Howie. So you've made this into a year-round business, and I know that you are selling in New York City, in the Union Square Green Market. And I want to hear about that experience and how you made those choices. And I want to know what it's like there.
Okay. I like to talk about that because we've been at the Green Market from the beginning.
The beginning. The Union Square Green Market started in 1976 with just a few farmers. It's grown to include over 80 regional farmers, fishers, bakers, and other producers since then.
Howie knew about the market. His parents lived in Manhattan at the time. And when he first sugared in 1983 for someone else, he was working for someone else, but part of his pay was syrup. And he knew about this fledgling farmers market at Union Square, Manhattan, and he got in touch and they said, sure, bring your syrup. So he went down and he sold it and he said, there's opportunity here. So we started sugaring 2 years later and we got in touch with Green Market. And this was in the very early years of Green Market. So they were really happy to have some maple syrup from Vermont. And we came into it, wow, it was so in the nascent. There weren't farmers markets in the country like there are now, not at all. It was amazing to see this market in the city and what the market was trying to do, which was to, one, help preserve farmland in a wide region around New York City against the pressures of urban suburban growth and the pressures of farming in any circumstance. So there was that, but then there was also this real goal to connect New Yorkers with their food and where their food comes from.
If you haven't listened to the first episode about the Union Square Green Market, I hope you will. At first, it was the wild, wild west of farmers selling to New Yorkers, and then it got more organized and grew its very powerful mission, like Stefan is talking about. Michael Hurwitz, Grow NYC's former director of green markets and Union Square's manager, Aquilino Cabral, really paint an impressive picture of what you see there, as well as the behind the scenes. It's episode 24. I will leave you a link in the show notes.
And just from the very beginning, we've really believed in that real marketplace. I mean, there's just nothing like it when you have people buying their food from the people who produce it, and relationships get built there, and customers understand not just where their food comes from, but what it takes to get it to them, and a little bit of what life is for the people who produce it. So it just seemed to be a fit with how I say we, but I'll speak for myself, how I saw what I saw as a huge need in this country, which was to come back to some sort of sustainable farming and away from industrializing and agriculture and commodifying everything. So that's been philosophically why we went to Green Market and why we're still there. And I've never gotten tired of it. I was there last weekend. I love talking to the customers. I love answering the questions. I love doing maple education. And it didn't start out as a full-time thing. Clearly, the first year, we didn't have that much syrup. We sold it for a few weeks in the spring and said, oh, that was cool. The next year, we asked to come back for additional weeks. And within a few years, we were going year-round. And for about 20 years, Howie and I took turns. One of us would stay home with the kids, and the other would go to New York. In the very beginning, we started with the Friday market at Union Square, which is now a 4-day-a-week market, and it's Green Market's flagship market. And then we added Thursday at the World Trade Center. There was a wonderful market at the World Trade Center. And then eventually we added Saturday at Union Square, and it just sort of has grown very organically. We never considered ourselves real business people. We didn't set out to make a business. We more set out to figure out a way to make a living.
That's a really beautiful connection, you know, between you and Vermont. And I know you're very close to the Canadian border, and then coming down to New York City and sitting in the middle of this market that really has a very passionate mission, like you described, of connecting people to their food and who grows it. I'm very interested to hear a little bit, if you have some stories you can share about your interaction with customers in New York City.
I would say that 36 years in the green market, it busts all the stereotypes about New Yorkers. I think of it, the market is like an oasis. It's this amazing place. It's a community, but it's just an amazing place in the city. And I think this is true of all the green market locations at this point, which is over 50 of them. But that people come into the market and they engage, they talk to strangers, they talk to the farmers, they drop their defenses, their shell a little bit, that kind of thing. You have to sort of have your street smarts when you're in the city, right? All that. They come into the market and the whole thing just relaxes a little. It's really nice. I think just the what it is creates that space that feels somehow like a safe place just to engage with people that in ways that you might not normally in such an intense urban environment.
Before 9/11, Deep Mountain Maple had a farm stand at the World Trade Center Farmers Market on the southeast corner of the World Trade Center Plaza. The market ran Tuesdays and Thursdays, and their farm stand day was Thursday. 9/11 happened on a Tuesday morning. I worked down there in the early 90s and would always take a break at lunch to walk through the market. It was like a little break from the intensity of work and the bustling area in general.
When we started selling there, we were making this maple candy. We just made the old-fashioned traditional version, which was only maple. And we had a lot of customers at that market from the Caribbean. I think a lot of Jamaican women. And they discovered our candy, and they got really excited about it because it's very similar to candy that's made in that region from sugarcane, which has various names depending where you are. It's in Jamaica, they call it fudge, but it's not fudge with dairy. It's just the name. In Spanish-speaking places, it's often called panela, but it's basically just the same. It's like a cake sugar candy. So these women from Jamaica would come and buy their candy, and they would tell me, they were older ladies, and they would sort of shake their finger in my face and say, "This is so good, just like what we had back home, but you should put ginger in it. You should put ginger in it, man." Or you should put coconut in it. And I heard this for months. And I said to this lady one day, I said, "We'd love to try that. Tell me how. What do we do if we want to put ginger in it?" So she told me, she described it to me. "Okay, this is what you do." And we tried it. And lo and behold, not only did it work, but it's this incredible flavor combination. Ginger and maple, it just works like you wouldn't believe. And so that became a huge hit. And so then we tried the coconut, and these are flavors we still have on the table. And that's all because of this wonderful cultural exchange about food that we had over the maple candy.
This cultural exchange has been a thread in the markets for years, decades even. As the green market has spread to more communities, the cultural exchanges have expanded too. Can you grow this? If you did, we would buy it because we had it back home and we love it and miss it. The farmers do, and everyone learns and benefits.
Then when 9/11 happened, and we continued to sell at Union Square for a long time after, I mean months, actually years. One of the very horrible and weird things for us was that we had all these great customers at World Trade Center. We knew them by face. Or maybe we knew a first name, but we didn't really know their names. So when the towers went down, we had no idea what happened to anybody. And it was very eerie. And so for weeks and months afterwards, every so often, without warning, somebody would just show up at Union Square who had been a customer down there. And we'd see this person that we had no idea if they had lived or died. We just didn't know. And there they are standing there. "Hi, remember me?" And it was amazing. It was so emotional. It was like, "Oh my God. Oh my God, you're okay." And the weird thing that I still think about is like how you can see someone every week, but you don't really know them, and you might not even know their name. So now, actually, we make more of a point of learning our customers' names.
I'm very interested in knowing how many gallons of maple syrup are you making in a year?
In a year, let's see, average, we hope to make 1,800 to 2,000 gallons of syrup in a year, in a good year. Beyond our green market business, we do a lot of wholesale to restaurants and food businesses. We have online sales. So in addition to the syrup we produce, we buy some syrup, but we're careful to buy it from people we know locally who have the same quality standards we do.
And also, I'm just curious about your commute to work.
It's almost 350 miles from here to Union Square. The way we started was because, A, as I said, we were not going to Green Market year-round. It was seasonal in the first several years. And my husband's dad was a professor at NYU, and they had a house that was very near Union Square where there was plenty of room for us to stay. So in those early days, we started doing it with having this really lucky, handy housing arrangement in Manhattan. Without that, I can't imagine we would have ever done such a crazy thing. And then, as I said, for the first 20 years, Holly and I would take turns. One week, somebody would stay home with the kids. The next week, they would go to New York. So it was back and forth. So if you were the person who went to New York, on the one hand, you got a break from the daily grind and parenting, and you got to go be the adult alone in New York City, which was fun. And if you were the one who didn't have to do that, you got to stay home, but you had all the family responsibilities. So it was a trade and it was a balance. And I think part of the reason we survived it was because we traded off. Like if one of us was going to the city all the time and having all the fun in the city, it wouldn't have worked because the one who had to stay home all the time and take care of the kids would have gotten resentful. So the fact that we were able to switch off made it work. Eventually, Howie realized that sort of the selling at the market, he still wants to be part of it and he loves it that we do it, but he kind of burned out on talking to people so much all the time. And me, I said, I don't get tired of it. So it kind of shifted over to I was going to New York more than he. It's a long drive. I mean, I tell people it's part of the job. It's trucking. It's not like if you get in a car to go on a road trip or something. It's like I get in the car and that's the work and I've got to just do the thing and get there. And then after about 20 years of a 700 mile commute, I burned out on it too and said, I can't do this all the time anymore. And that's when we hired a manager in the city, and our manager now runs the stand for us and is always there at Union Square on Friday and Saturday. And he has spent a lot of time here on the farm during production or not. So he really understands everything about it and takes great care of the thing down there. And so we don't have to go so much anymore, but it's still, I mean, again, Green Market has a very serious commitment to having the producers present at market for the customers, for that relationship. And I take it seriously too. So I still make sure I'm there at least once a month. And in our big selling season, which is when the weather gets cool in the fall up through the holidays, we get very, very busy. And so then I'm there quite a bit more to help out. But I've cut way back from the amount of time I used to spend in New York. Another thing that happened several years ago that really revolutionized things for us for the better is when a woman named Annie Myers, who had formerly lived in New York and worked in food business there, moved to the Northeast Kingdom. That's this part of Vermont. And saw a need and opened a trucking company. And she now trucks farm products, agricultural products, food, from the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont to New York City and Boston on a regular basis every week.
This is a huge deal. The two, I like to call it. The two in farm to table actually deserves an underscore and to be in all caps. The two is the tricky part. Meyer's Produce is a regional distributor that connects New York City, Western Massachusetts, and Northern Vermont. They have been in operation since 2013 and offer regional growers and producers distribution, as in they will find a buyer for farmers' products, and freight, where they will be the two in the farm to table for the farm.
So we can now send syrup on the Meyer's truck to New York City. What was an amazing serendipity for us was that one of their drop-off places happens to be the warehouse where we have storage space in Brooklyn. So we can put syrup on the truck here in Hardwick, Vermont, and it'll go directly to Brooklyn. And that was huge, because even after Howie and I stopped driving to the city every week, we still had to figure out how to truck the syrup down there every week.
Yeah, Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben, come on. Yeah, 10-4, Big Ben, for sure, for sure. By golly, it's clean clear to Flagtown, come on.
We did a lot of years, we did this, not crazy thing, but.
Good buddy, mercy sakes alive, looks like we've got us a convoy.
We would meet each other halfway. We still do that sometimes when we're in a pinch or an emergency. But basically, Meyer's Trucking has really opened things up for us. And this is important as an example of something that I see as a key and real challenge for sustainable food production going forward. So over the time we've been in the food business, we've seen a huge growth in craft foods, beverages, beers, artisanal products, cheeses. I mean, and Vermont is such an incubator for all of that. It's been amazing, the support we've gotten in this state and how much growth there's been in this, in craft and cottage food businesses and in sustainable agriculture. But then what happens is, okay, I can produce what I can produce, but I have to be able to get it to market. And if I'm way up here in the northeast corner of Vermont, my markets where there's big populations, they're hours away. Boston is 3.5 hours from here. New York's 6.5 hours. So those logistical businesses, those needs that we have for transport and packaging and all these things are so important to the whole, to a sustainable food economy. We as producers, we can produce, but then we need the pieces in place to be able to get what we produce to market, to the people who want it. And sure, online sales, yeah, they're great. I do some online shopping myself. But I go back to what I said, I really believe in the real marketplace. I see the convenience of online shopping, don't get me wrong. But boy, I think we lose something as human societies and as economies if we aren't dealing with each other on a more personal level. So I'm just saying a shout out to all the folks like Annie Myers and others who are working to find ways to bring all this good stuff to people who want it.
I have long been obsessed with the two and farm to table. There's a table and there's a farm and there's a path. I really think of that like Union Square Market too, is a part of that too.
Incredible. what that's done. I mean, there are tens of thousands of acres in farming and farmland in the several hundred miles around New York City that I guarantee you would not be in farmland still without the green market. Because to give us a place to sell retail directly to people, it's huge.
When a farmer is able to sell directly to a customer instead of to a processor who is between the farmer and the customer, the farmer is able to get a better price. While the cost to the consumer might not be any higher, the yield to the farmer is better than if a processor bought it and charged the farmer essentially for the connection with the consumer. For a small farmer, a wholesale business might not be enough to keep them in business.
These things are starting to happen. That's what I'm saying, which is very encouraging that it is starting to happen. Whereas 30 years ago, there was nothing like Myers Trucking existed. I'm looking out my window right now at the maple trees. It's a pretty magical, and yeah, sugaring does become a passion, or is. It sort of has to be, because otherwise it's nuts. You're out there and you're tapping when there's 4 feet of snow and you're on snowshoes and you're falling through the snow. And then right now it's like there's mud everywhere. It's a crazy time of year. It's like pre-spring, but it's just this reminder every year that it's going to happen. It's this great thing about hope and faith that it will come. And the sap will flow and we'll make syrup and spring will come again. And it's been a wonderful way to live.
Being a sugar maker in the sugar bush takes passion, a love for the trees and the seasons, and a tolerance for their ebbs and flows. To bring the sap to the sugar house, you have to be a strong networker, linking one tree to the next and frugally harvesting just the right amount from each tree so the tree can still thrive, and you can use that sap to make deliciously rich, sticky syrup for my pancakes. When I was little, in the 70s, fake syrup was de rigueur, and my taste developed in that direction until one day I sopped my French toast, a sweet ready breakfast I like better than any other, in a small pitcher of the real thing. I was hooked. My kids never had the faux syrup, and I am nostalgic for the Saturdays following sleepovers where maple syrup took up its place as the breakfast table's centerpiece. With all of the times that I have oohed and aahed over my syrup-soaked French toast, I don't think I've really considered the sugar maker. Now I can't imagine it without thinking of Stefan and Howie trudging through the snow-covered hills of Vermont or driving the 6.5 hours to the green market at New York City's Union Square. That's what Talk Farm to Me is all about, getting closer to farmers, understanding what they do to bring us the best, most delicious foods, the ones we rely on, the ones we can't live without, and that deserve no substitute. With Stefan Center Stage, we get a real, honest glimpse into the life of the sugar maple trees and their loving stewards. Stay tuned next week for more farmers, more food, more behind the scenes with farmers. When you listen, you understand. When you understand, you are the one in the know and can be their biggest supporters and advocates. That is my hope for you and for farmers. Do Stefan and I a favor, okay? Share this episode with someone who loves pancakes drenched in maple syrup. You know who I'm talking about. Do it. They will thank you. Until next week, I am your faithful host, Farm Girl, and this is Talk Farm to Me.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen, remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.